And these critics today date the book of Daniel in about 165 B.C., which is at the time of a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, who was not a real pleasant individual, and he was causing Judah a great amount of trouble during the time of the Maccabees. Some of their stronger arguments, and we will rebut each one of these. The first one, they say there are three Greek words in the book of Daniel. And there are. Find three Greek words. As far as looking at, there's three words, and you can tell they've come from the Greek language. And they've come over into the Hebrew of the book of Daniel. And they say this means that it was written after the time of Alexander, because Alexander in the 330s B.C. conquered the known world. And he left the Grecian influence, the Hellenization, everywhere that he went. So in order to get three Greek words into the book of Daniel, it's got to be written after the time of Alexander. That's what their thinking is. The three words are names of musical instruments. They're names of musical instruments. The first, and they're found in Daniel 3, verses 5 and 15. Daniel 3, verses 5 and 15. And as far as the King James translating them, it's the dulcimer, the harp, and the psaltery. And I think it would be easiest to write this up here. So in Daniel 3, verses 5 and 15, you find these three instruments. The dulcimer, D-U-L-C-I-M-E-R, the harp, H-A-R-P, and the psaltery, P-S-A-L, T-E-R-Y. So, dulcimer, harp, psaltery. The Greek words that are used, symphonia, S-U-M-P-H-O-N-I-A, and it's a long O. The harp is the katharis, K-I-T-H. A-R-I-S, K-I-T-H-A-R-I-S, and then the psaltery, P-S-A-L-T-E-R-I-O-N, and it's a long E, psalterion. So the dulcimer is the Greek symphonia, and harp is the Greek katharis, and psaltery is the Greek psalterion. So that's what you find in the book of Daniel. You find these three words, these three Greek words, carried over into the Old Testament scriptures. And since the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, this is seems kind of peculiar. And these critics have found these three Greek words and say, well, this had to be written after the time of Alexander, or else how could these Greek words get in here? Now, we have to understand, first of all, that such names, especially for musical instruments, have always circulated beyond their national borders. Just always. Instruments always became available on foreign markets. And kings of other lands always wanted new instruments. Yeah?
Are you saying that Greek and Hebrew were both
spoken? Oh, no, not at all. No, Greek is, well, in the land of Greece, yes, of course. But not in the land of Babylon. I mean, in the land of Palestine. We're talking about the land of Palestine, and we're also talking about Daniel being in Babylon, okay?
During the Old Testament.
The book of Daniel, we're dealing with 500 B.C., somewhere in that vicinity. I can't remember the exact date on it. And The Jewish people, they're not speaking Greek, and they're speaking Hebrew until until Hebrew becomes a dead language in Babylon, and then they speak Aramaic. But they're not speaking Greek. But the whole point is, these higher critics, they come to the book of Daniel, and the book of Daniel is a big problem for them. And these things are important for you to realize, so don't go to sleep tonight. Do try to pay attention. It's not that difficult. These points are not that hard to follow. These higher critics want to do anything to get the book of Daniel written after they want these events to have happened and then Daniel to write as a historical record rather than a prophetic thing. That's the whole point of this. So they've got to search for things that make their position seem plausible. And in this case, they find something, and they've done better in this case than what they do with most of their arguments. Most of them are completely idiotic. At least this one has what appears to be some basis at first glance. And they say, well, as you look through the book of Daniel, if it was written back in the 500s, when the Jewish people did not speak Greek, because after they come out of Babylon, they don't speak Hebrew. They speak Aramaic. And that's in about 536 B.C. Babylonian captivity is from 606 to 536. Then Alexander the Great, he conquers the known world in the 300s B.C. And when he does that, Koine Greek becomes the universal language of the people. And it becomes a language of commerce. So that Jewish people, as well as Babylonians, as well as Phoenicians, as well as Egyptians, as well as those in Asia Minor, as well as those in Rome, as well as anybody, they have Greek as one of their languages. And virtually everybody is at least bilingual. They have their own national language and they speak Greek. So they say, well, this Greek would not be in the book of Daniel, except now the Jewish people are speaking Greek. And so that's what they're making their appeal to. But that appeal is absurd. Now, Greek was being spoken in Greece. Where else would it be spoken? It was not a world language yet. And you say, well, then how did the Greek get in here? The main reason is because musical instruments have always circulated beyond their borders. This is musical instruments. They always circulate on foreign markets. They always do. When you talk about musical instruments, you're talking about something that was important to kings and rulers. And they always wanted to be familiar with what other people had been inventing and other instruments and other forms of music. They were always wanting to do that. And they always wanted these kind of things to be in their courts. See, in the king's court, they always wanted things like this. Now, the point then is, because you find the Greek words, they're trying to say that Alexander the Great has already conquered the known world. But that doesn't make any sense, any more than it makes any sense that just because we have the Italian words piano and viola in our English language, that we have already been invaded and overcome by the Italians. And that we were defeated by them. And so that's the reason we have the word piano and the word viola in our language. Everybody knows that Italy attacked a number of years ago and now runs our nation. Everybody knows that, don't they? That should be obvious because we got the word piano and the word viola in our language. That doesn't prove a thing. You can have words from other languages. We've embraced a lot of different words that we don't even know where they came from. We don't know. They may have Mexican roots. They may have German roots. They may have French roots. They may have Italian roots. They may have all sorts of background to them. But that doesn't mean that we were once defeated by Spain, once defeated by Germany, once defeated by Mexico, once defeated by whoever you want to name. It doesn't mean that at all. So Italy has not conquered the United States, and they don't have to conquer the United States before we can have some of their words in our language. And Hebrew people, Jewish people, do not have to be conquered by Greece before they can have some words from the Grecian language as part of their vocabulary. And it's very common for such things. Archaeology shows that as early as the time of Sargon, and this is 722 to 705 B.C., so this predates the book of Daniel. Sargon was a king of Assyria, and this corresponds to the time period of the book of Isaiah. And it shows that there were Greek captives sold as slaves into Assyria. Well, when you have Greek captives sold as slaves in Assyria, sooner or later, if some of these slaves end up as being servants in rich people's homes, and they can tell these rich people about some things concerning the Greek culture, it won't be too long before there'll be Grecian things imbibed in the Assyrian culture. I mean, that's just what happens. And then when you find out that Assyria later takes Israel, you see a connection between Assyria and Israel, and it wouldn't be that difficult for Israel to imbibe a few words from this as well. It wouldn't be that difficult at all. A Greek poet in 600 B.C., and this corresponds to the time that Daniel is in Babylon, writes of his brother serving in the Assyrian army. So it shows Greek people far outside the borders of their own land. And if they're outside the borders of their own land, it's going to cause an influence, possibly. So you can see even from that the possibility of words coming into another language. If Daniel was written in 165 B.C., then there should be many, many, many more Greek words than just three. There should be a lot more. Because by 165 B.C., those Jews living in the areas of Palestine, they would have probably imbibed many more Greek words than just three. And they would have undoubtedly imbibed other words besides just words of musical instruments. See, this thing about musical instruments, it's to understand that there was always a desire to want to see what other kings had in their courts. And these men are not being entertained by marvelous prayer meetings, by worshiping God. They are looking for every type of carnal entertainment available. And so they're always looking for ways to be more fully entertained. And music has always been a part of that. So they hear about a certain instrument that the Greeks use, they'll spare no expense in bringing that to their court. It's just a very common thing. And remember, Daniel is in Babylon. Now, how powerful is Babylon? Babylon is really powerful. And they are trying, they're controlling all sorts of people, all sorts of nations. And after a while, they're going to be a very cosmopolitan nation, as far as imbibing certain key things from various cultures and adding that to their own culture. They're going to be doing that. So you would expect there to be these kind of words. When you're talking about Daniel being in Babylon, you'd expect something like this. But that doesn't put Daniel written at 165 B.C. There's no reason for it to be written at that time. Now, another confirmation of the early date of the book of Daniel is that Daniel is written in both Aramaic as well as in Hebrew. The Aramaic portion of the book of Daniel is from chapter 2, verse 4, to chapter 7, verse 28. And it's significant that this portion, Daniel 3, verses 5 and 15, are found in this. See, from chapter 2, verse 4, to chapter 7, verse 28, the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic. It is not written in Hebrew. Aramaic, essentially, is a language of Babylon. And so, it shows that Daniel is there in Babylon, and it proves that it's written during the time of the exile. This is what you would expect, with a transition being made from Hebrew to Aramaic. If it was written in 165 B.C., there would be no Hebrew. Because during the time of the Maccabees, and that's what that period of time is known at, about 165 in there, it's known as the time of the Maccabees, the people were not speaking Hebrew. They were speaking only Aramaic. And the only people that could even speak the Hebrew, and the only reason they kept conversing in it, were the priests, because they had to read the scriptures. But the common people could not speak Hebrew nor read it anymore. It became a dead language. When they came out of Babylon, Hebrew was virtually extinct. And they had embraced the language of Babylon. So what kind of words do you find in the language of Babylon? You find some Greek words. That's what you would expect. Because it's in the courts of Babylon that you have these musical instruments. So they're going to have these words from the Greek language. They're going to have them because they have those instruments in their court. I hope you understand that the historical situation here. Daniel is in Babylon. And in Babylon, they're speaking Aramaic. That's what the Babylonians speak. That's the Chaldeic language, basically. Now, some say it's a common Aramaic becomes a combination of Hebrew and Chaldeic, but that's a little hard to say for sure. Most of the scholars feel that Aramaic equals Chaldeic, and I'm not sure exactly how to spell Chaldeic, so we'll stop right there. And that's the language of Babylon. So you've got the language of Babylon, which is Aramaic or Chaldeic. Now, Daniel is in Babylon during the captivity, and the captivity is from 606 to 536 BC. And these critics are trying to say that the book of Daniel was written in 165 BC, so that it's written as a historical record, not a prophetic record. Okay? That's what's going on. Now in Babylon, when the Jews went there, they spoke Hebrew. So you've got the people of Judah went to Babylon. And when they're in Babylon, that's when they were called Jews. They weren't called Jews until that time. And they were labeled as Jews in Babylon. And those Jews spoke Hebrew. But when they left Babylon, they no longer spoke Hebrew. Because during the time that they were there in captivity, they embraced the language of Babylon, which is Aramaic. Now, Daniel is written in both languages. That's what you would expect for a book written during the exile. It shows the transition that was taking place from Hebrew to Aramaic. It's in the Aramaic language that you have these three Greek words. It's in Chaldeic. See, it's from chapter 2 through chapter 7, and the verses that involve these musical instruments were there in chapter 3. So that portion is in Aramaic. Well, that's what you would expect because of the way Babylon was. Babylon was concerned to be top, first class in everything. And you can imagine that they're importing all sorts of things from all over the known world. Money is no concern to them. They're going to find the finest instruments. They're going to find the finest metals, the finest materials. They're going to bring in the finest soldiers at times if they would need to hire any from other nations or whatever they might have to do. They're going to do that. And forms of entertainment were always an important part of any of these kind of kingdoms because they didn't have anything else. So you would expect them to have something like this. So that's what the situation is. And the point that I was making concerning that in 165 B.C., that involves the Maccabees. I think it's M-A-C-C-A-B-E-E-S. And this is just what was known as this. There is the intertestament period, which is from 400 B.C., which is where the last writing, the last book of the canon of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. So from 400 B.C. until the time of John the Baptist, there's no prophet in Judah, no prophet at all. John the Baptist is the first one to come for 400 years. That's known as the intertestament period, and part of that time is known as the period of the Maccabees. And the Maccabees were a prominent family that tried to get the rulers of Syria and Greek rulers out of the land of Palestine. And it was a time of revolt, and it was a time of a lot of fighting and bloodshed and things of that nature. And if Daniel was written in 165 B.C., well, by that time, they're not speaking Hebrew anymore, so nobody would put anything in the book of Daniel in Hebrew. and you'd see a lot more Greek words than just three. So it doesn't make any sense it was written in 165. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Am I correct in assuming that chapters 1, 2, and the first three verses,
yes,
are prior to the Exodus?
No. Absolutely not. The book, it's all written during the exile. And don't worry about chapter and verse divisions. They're just in there for convenience. But for some reason, as God was inspiring the book, he has what we look at as chapters 1 and chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, written in Hebrew. And then in verse 4, he starts talking in Aramaic, and there's probably a change there. There's probably something that happens. I'm not familiar with exactly what happens at that point historically. But it isn't that first part's prior to the exile, and then the rest is during the exile, and then after chapter 7, it's before the exile again. No, it's nothing like that at all. Daniel's in the exile. He's there in Babylon. As he's writing this, God's inspiring him. He writes the first part in Hebrew. He writes the next portion in Aramaic. He writes the last part in Hebrew. Why exactly, we don't know, other than to show that it's during the time of the exile. Yes?
You were saying that the priests and the people like that, you know, that speak Hebrew,
mm-hmm.
still, what would they argue at that point?
It wouldn't serve any purpose. The book was written to, in the estimation of these critics, was written to spur the people on during the time of the Maccabees revolt. And the Maccabees revolt was the common people. It wasn't just priests. So it wouldn't do any good to have a priest that could write and speak Hebrew, and he throws in some Hebrew here and then gives it to the common person, and he opens it up and he says, well, this portion's great, it's in Aramaic, but what's this saying? That's in Hebrew. See, that wouldn't make any sense. Yeah, they did. They probably did speak. No. Remember, Jews are bilingual. They speak Aramaic and Greek. So remember the day of Pentecost. Those Jews there, they spoke the language from the land that they came from for the feast. They spoke Aramaic, which gave them a unity amongst the Jewish people, and they spoke Greek because it was a world universal language. So if you lived in Palestine, you were bilingual. If you lived outside Palestine, you were a Jew, you were trilingual. And most of the people throughout all the known world during that time were bilingual at least. They spoke their own language and they spoke Greek. Okay. Now, also, the type of Aramaic that you find in the Maccabean period differs from the Aramaic of Daniel's time. See, the Aramaic went through a change. Languages go through evolution. The English of 1611 is not the English of 1982. The English of 1910 is not the English of 1982. You don't need that many years for there to be a change. But from 536 to 165 BC, that's a long period of time. And the Aramaic that you find in the book of Daniel is not the same that you find during the time of the Maccabees. It's not the same Aramaic. So that's another proof that it wasn't written in 165 BC. The Aramaic of Daniel is similar, not identical, but similar to what is found in the Elephantine papyri. E-L-E-P-H-A-N T-I-N-E. Just write the word elephant and then add an I, an N, and an E. Elephantine papyri. P-A-P-Y-R-I. And this is just some documents that archaeologists have discovered. And they date these between 500 and 400 B.C. And so this goes quite a bit. It's much closer to the time of Daniel in Babylon. And the Aramaic in the book of Daniel and the Aramaic in these Elephantine papyri are very similar. Very similar. See, that just shows, it's another point showing that the 165 date is unreasonable. It's not a proper date. So that's what you have here with these words. And what I'm giving you as rebuttal, they're very strong arguments. And a higher critic can't do anything with them. He has found three Greek words, and then he builds this huge assumption. And he's just trying to get the book of Daniel written as a historical record. That's his whole purpose. He does not believe in prophecy. He does not believe in the supernatural. He does not believe there's any way that God could show man what was going to happen, let alone have man record it. He just doesn't believe that at all. Now, another thing is the mention of Belshazzar. B-E-L-S-H-A-Z-Z-A-R. Belshazzar. B-E-L-S-H-A-Z-Z-A-R. And he's mentioned as ruler in Babylon. There's the mention of Belshazzar as ruler in Babylon. And this was said to be an error, because only the book of Daniel speaks of him. So these higher critics, they found, okay, the book of Daniel mentions Belshazzar. And it says that he was ruler in Babylon. But only the book of Daniel mentions it. So therefore, the book of Daniel must be wrong. They could never say, well, therefore the book of Daniel must be right. It's got to be wrong. And they say, well, see, secular history knew nothing of him. It's just another fabrication, the book of Daniel. It shows it's not inspired. It shows it's written by somebody who doesn't really know what he's talking about. Now, all indications from secular history were that a man named Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. N-A-B-O-N-I-D-U-S. So they say that Nabonidus was the last king. That's what secular history says. Nabonidus. But then Nabonidus is not mentioned in the book of Daniel. Therefore, Daniel was written by an uninformed person that wasn't back there. See, written by somebody who was not familiar with the real history. It's written by somebody who was not in the Babylonian captivity. Because everybody knows that you'd want to give a sterling historical record. But that just shows they don't really understand the purpose of Scripture. Scripture is not just a history book. And really, in no way is it a history book. Whatever history is conveyed, the purpose is not to convey history, it's to convey truth. And if history can be used to convey some truth, well, then that's what God has done. So you have this problem between Belshazzar and Nabonidus. Well, in 1853, they found an inscription, an archaeologist found an inscription, in a temple built by Nabonidus. And it was built at Ur of the Chaldees. So we've got a temple that was built by Nabonidus at the Ur of the Chaldees. And the inscription said, "May I, Nabonidus, king of Babylon, not sin against thee, and may reverence for thee dwell in the heart of Belshazzar, my firstborn favorite son." Well, look at what we have. Lo and behold, there's Belshazzar. Other inscriptions show that Nabonidus was in retirement outside Babylon, and Belshazzar was his co-regent. And he was the co-regent over the army and the government. Now this explains Daniel 5, verse 29, where it mentions that Daniel became the third ruler in Babylon. This explains how he was the third ruler. And this also explains why Nabonidus wouldn't be mentioned. Because he was not really ruling in Babylon. And it was also, he just was not a significant character at this time for God to record anything about him. He was in retirement. He was still the king. But his son was the co-regent king with him. And the son was over the army and over the government in Babylon. And Daniel, by this time, had been raised up to be the third highest ruler in the land. How do you get the third highest ruler? Because you've got Nabonidus, you've got Belshazzar, and then you have Daniel. People making an attack on the Scripture, and then later God brings information to light that shows that it's accurate once again. Now, there are other arguments, but these are the stronger ones. The others are much weaker and easily refuted. All proof so shows Daniel written approximately at 530 BC, somewhere in that time frame, which is long before the prophecies concerning Greece, Rome, and the end times. Even if Daniel was written in 165 BC, it still prophesies things that have not occurred. So even if it was, it still has a prophetic record in it. But everything shows that it was not written in 165. It wasn't even close to that time. It has to But it's not just a historical book. It has prophetic things. So you just need to understand how these musical instruments, you just find records of musical instruments in all sorts of lands, and that doesn't prove that somebody conquered somebody or everybody speaking some language. Doesn't prove anything like that. And just understanding basically that information there, and how the Aramaic in the book of Daniel is not even similar to that of 165, the Maccabean period. It goes back further in time. Also, it's what you would expect for the book of Daniel, showing Hebrew and Aramaic, showing the transition that was involved there. The Jewish people moving from the Hebrew language to the Aramaic language. Now, the Bible has never been proven wrong historically or scientifically. It's never been proven wrong historically or scientifically. And all the attacks stem from man rejecting God. All the attacks stem from man rejecting God. The next area that we want to discuss is science and the Bible. Science and the Bible. The Bible is a book of knowledge, and all true science will agree with the Bible. There are no scientific facts that will ever be in contradiction to the Bible. Now, there will be plenty of theories in contradiction to the Bible, but no facts. People think that because the Bible was written so long ago, that it's going to be terribly inaccurate scientifically. It's not at all. Because it wasn't men writing what they knew about science, it's what God knows about science. And God knows quite a bit about science. The Bible makes no scientific errors. There are no scientific errors in the book. We have to realize, of course, that the Bible is not a textbook of science in the sense of technical data. It doesn't have physics formulas. But it does make statements dealing with natural phenomena. And wherever it makes these statements, it is infallible. It makes accurate statements about science. Wherever God wanted to throw in something about science, it's accurate. If the Bible is ever wrong in one area, then it may also be untrue elsewhere. When these statements are made and you find that they're coming from God, they're not the record of Job's wife telling Job to curse God and die. They're not the record of the devil trying to tempt Christ, so therefore Scripture is twisted. They're not the record of some carnal king who's upset at some prophet, and so you have a wrong statement recorded. We're not talking about those statements. Wherever God has said something, wherever something's been prophesied, wherever something's been given out in Scripture concerning something of science from a man of God, a prophet of God, an apostle of God, it's always accurate. Now, if you find that they were wrong on any of those points, then maybe they were also wrong in their theology. You see, we can't afford to have any of these statements be wrong. We really can't. It's so important. Now, there are those today, I want to read a statement, and they don't realize there are many people, so-called scholars, and they don't understand the significance that if the Bible is not completely infallible, completely inerrant, they don't really see that as a problem. They say, well, yeah, the Bible's got mistakes, and if it's got mistakes, no big deal. They are so blind. This is a really serious thing. It is a big controversy out in the church world today. Now, this man's name is Robert Bratcher, and he's an ordained Southern Baptist minister. And I think he's one of the wolves in sheep's clothing. Generally, the Baptist Church, Southern Baptist, pretty strong, pretty steadfast on inspiration. But he made this statement in Christianity Today on May 29th, 1981. He said, "Only willful ignorance or intellectual dishonesty can account for the claim that the Bible is inerrant and infallible." So he says, if we make the claim that the Bible is inerrant and infallible, that's intellectual dishonesty, or else willful ignorance. That's a pretty sad statement. No truth-loving, God-respecting, Christ-honoring believer should be guilty of such heresy. To invest the Bible with qualities of inerrancy and infallibility is to idolize it, to transform it into a false god. Now, this poor man is really deceived. Now, Bratcher was the translator of the Bible, Good News for Modern Man. And he's a research associate with the American Bible Society. And he made this comment while speaking to the Christian Life Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention on the topic, Biblical Authority for the Church Today. And the article says here, undoubtedly Bratcher was not speaking for either the Southern Baptist or the American Bible Society. When this reporter contacted the headquarters for the Southern Baptist Convention, a spokesman commented, "The Southern Baptist Convention does not have a definite stand on the inerrancy of the Bible. This has been a continuing controversy over the past few years, and the controversy is getting more and more intense." And we'll find, and I mentioned this, and you'll see it more so, and there are scholars that have already recognized it, other men of God, other teachers, and they've recognized it a long time ago. They've come to see that the position somebody holds concerning the inspiration, infallibility, and inerrancy of the Bible will say a lot as to where your commitment really is with God. And whether you're liberal, conservative, really love Jesus, really dedicated to God, love the world, your position that a man holds on the inspiration of Scripture tells a lot about what his real commitment to God is. And it will become more and more obvious in the days ahead. So this man feels like if you even thought of labeling the Bible as infallible, that's intellectual dishonesty. If the Bible is not infallible, we're in a lot of trouble. Because if it's in error at any one point, then who's to say it's not in error on other points? Now, as one can see from the Bible, not only is it scientifically accurate, but it also has anticipated a number of scientific discoveries. And I want to mention a few of these. The Bible speaks very clearly concerning the rain cycle. And I don't know when that was discovered, but it wasn't one of man's first inventions. It wasn't one of the first things that he figured out. We think it's pretty simple. It took man a long time to figure out how the rain cycle really operates. I don't know the date on that, but it wasn't something that goes way back to the times of Christ. It has taken scientists a long time to figure out the rain cycle. But the Bible speaks about it very clearly. In Job 36, verses 26 to 28, Ecclesiastes 1, verses 6 and 7, Psalm 135, verse 7, also Jeremiah 10, verse 13. So it's talking about the rain cycle, and you can read those verses. And it's very clear, showing about the clouds, comes from the horizon and the rain, and a number of interesting statements are made. A second thing that the Bible speaks of, and nobody figured this one out for quite a long time, is that the earth is a globe, that it's a circle, it's a sphere, it's globular. They had to wait for Columbus to sail the ocean blue to figure out it wasn't a table. And even after he did that, many people would not accept it. They still would not accept that it was a circle. Wouldn't even begin to think of accepting it that way. You've got Job chapter 26, verse 7. That's Job 26, 7. Proverbs 8, verse 27. Isaiah 40, verse 22. And then Luke 17, verses 34 to 36. Now, another thing that is spoken of is the earth's atmosphere. There is an atmosphere that surrounds our globe, our planet. It took scientists a long time to figure that out. But Isaiah chapter 40, verse 22. Like there's a blanket that lays right over the earth. And without that blanket, we would be destroyed. The atmosphere is very important. Isaiah 40, verse 22. Another point, this is not a real pleasant one, but it's interesting, the Bible forbids incest. And during the Dark Ages, the kings, in their demented state of mind, in order to try to preserve their royalty, involved themselves greatly in incest, because they felt that that would keep producing a stronger, more intelligent race of people. And it produced more and more people with all sorts of physical retardation, mental retardation, and there's a lot of historical record on this. But in the book of Leviticus, chapter 18, verses 6 to 18, God said, don't do it. And God set it up that way, as a safeguard, because he saw what the curse of sin would do down through the history of man. And if you marry too close to your immediate relatives, it could have serious effect upon those children, which it does have. And unfortunately, there's still people today finding that out, sadly. Another thing is the composition of man. And what I mean here is that it has been discovered that the blood types for man and for animals are unique. You can take the blood of an animal and you always know it's the blood of an animal. You can take the blood of a man and you know always know that it's the blood of a man. And the scripture talks about this, makes statements in this direction. Genesis 2 and verse 7, Job 4, verse 19, Acts 17, verse 26, and then 1 Corinthians 15, verse 39. And then one other one is, this is not necessarily real clear, but it's worth considering, and this concerns the atomic structure. The fact that everything is built upon atoms, built upon simpler elements. And put Colossians 1, verse 17, also 2 Peter 3, verse 12. Now, 2 Peter 3, 12 says this, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Now this word elements is stoichion, S-T-O-I-C-H-E-I-O-N, S-T-O-I-C-H-E-I-O-N, stoichion. That's the Greek word for elements. And he's talking about the elements, they're going to burn up. So what is he saying? Well, this word primarily signifies any first thing from which others in a series or a composite whole arise. And Vine says it denotes an element or first principle. And it was used of the letters of the alphabet. And the letters of the alphabet are the elements of speech. Or you could say the letters of the alphabet are the building blocks of language. So this word is referring to the first things. Now, as far as what we look at, what are the first things that make up material objects? Atoms. And they've got to be joined together in a series. They've got to be joined together in a composite whole, and then you have things produced. Things exist. And atoms are the building blocks. And it's very possible that this word, as far as from God's view, is speaking about atoms. Now, Peter didn't know anything about it. He didn't know anything about the atomic structure. He was not aware of it. But I don't think Job was necessarily aware of the rain cycle. I don't think Isaiah was aware that the earth was a circle when he said that it was. I don't think they really understood these things. When they were trying to keep George Washington alive, the doctors at that time believed that the disease was in the blood. And so there was what is known as bloodletting. And they actually bled him to death. But if they had known Leviticus 17:11, which says the life is in the blood, they would have never done that. And by coincidence, there was a Bible on his nightstand right next to his bed. And they bled him to death. And that's exactly how he died. That's the historical record of how George Washington died. I don't think that... Now, you would... Probably when Moses is writing the book of Leviticus and he says the life is in the blood, he probably doesn't really know what that means. He probably does not understand how important the blood is in each person in a medical sense. Then again, he may have had somewhat of a revelation. And some of these others may have had certain revelation as they wrote. But that doesn't mean that they understood it in a full scientific sense. I would think in most cases they probably did not. There are many examples of prophecies that are written, and the men looked into it and said, what does this mean? And like God said to Daniel, go your way, it's sealed until the time of the end. The angels even want to look into it and can't look into it. It hasn't been given for them to know, for them to understand. But here in St. Peter, the physical elements, very possibly it's referring to the atoms. And they're the building blocks of the physical universe. And when the physical universe is destroyed, what's going to be melted? What's going to be destroyed with it? All the atoms. There will not be a need for those atoms any longer because there will not be a physical material realm any longer. I don't think our glorified bodies will be made of atoms. I don't know what they'll be made of, but they won't be atoms. Atoms are of the physical. We're not going to be of the physical. So you're talking about elements of a physical realm. Those things are going to be burned up. I think it's pointing to the atomic structure. And those elements are going to be destroyed. Thus our earth and life as we know it will cease to exist. I think that's just another thing that was written through penmen that anticipated things scientifically. Now, remember, theories might conflict with the Bible, but facts will not. Facts will not conflict with the Bible. If you find something that's conflicting with the Bible, I will guarantee it's not factual. It's not a fact. Evolution doesn't have any place in the Bible. And people are saying evolution is conflicting with the Bible all the time. And you say, yes, of course it is, because the evolution is a theory. And theories will conflict with the Bible. That doesn't mean every theory will. Some theories have been proven to be fact. Evolution will never be proven to be fact. Now another section is we'll label as scripture and logic. scripture and logic. Now, the underlying fundamental principle behind evolution, and it's also described as uniformitarianism, higher criticism, humanism, modernism, etc., is unbelief. That's the underlying fundamental principle behind those things. It's unbelief. It's very simple. Men assume that God does not exist, or if he does, he can't do anything. It's either or, and they don't care. Man shows he loves darkness rather than light. This is what Jesus said in John chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. This is important because it allows us to know what is really in the hearts of these individuals. Now, some of it's being done in ignorance, and they don't really love darkness more than light. They just don't know what the light is. But there are many of them that have actually, in fact, rejected the light because they love the darkness. And some of them have had contact with very supernatural things of God, and they just said, I don't want any part of it, and they've walked away from it. This heart of unbelief causes them to deny all Bible miracles. And some then just ignore the Bible, but others decide they're going to explain them away. And one of the prime examples of rationalistic, liberal interpretation is concerning Israel's crossing of the Red Sea. And they take this mighty miracle and they try to explain it away as follows. They say that Israel did not cross the Red Sea. They crossed the Reed Sea. Just add another E to it. And they say that it's the Reed Sea because the Hebrew can mean either red or reed. And obviously nobody can go through a real sea. That's not possible. They have boats. It's too far to swim. Yeah, just absurd. Of course it had to be a shallow portion of water. And the Reed Sea is a marshland north of the Red Sea. And the water there is about 6 inches deep. And as far as the wind that blew, that was just a natural wind, and that just kind of inspired the people. And they charged across there, and in their excitement, they talked about how they escaped Pharaoh. And then later, it became that somehow the water swallowed up Pharaoh, and somehow they won a big victory over the Egyptians. And you know how things are, tall tales after many, many years of passing stories down the line. And before you know it, you have this biblical record, but it's all fallacy. Well, let's see if we can rebut this. First of all, the Red Sea in Hebrew is Yam Suf. Two words. Yam, Y-A-M, Y-A-M, and then Suf, S-U-P-H. And the word Yam means sea. A noisy sea with a surf, with waves coming in. And it comes from a root word meaning to rear. Like waves do, they rear up and then they come crashing in. It's like they rear up and they come crashing in. And that's, it comes from a root word meaning that, to rear. The idea of to rear up, like waves do. And when this word yam is found with a definite article, we have the definite article and then this word yam, it's always speaking of the Mediterranean Sea. So I don't see there's any way that yam can ever have reference to a marshland. So with the definite article, it means the Mediterranean. The word suf means weeds. It does not mean reeds. Like weeds that you find in an ocean. The weeds that Jonah found down there in the belly of the whale. He didn't find reeds. He found weeds. You find reeds in a marshland. You don't find seaweed there. You only find seaweed in an ocean, in a large body of water. And it is the same word that's used in Jonah 2, verse 5. Same Hebrew word, Jonah 2, verse 5. Let me make two other points, and then we can start on another next time. Red seaweed is abundant in the Red Sea. That's at least one of the reasons why it's called the Red Sea. Another reason is because there's red coral that lines the shores. And there's also red sandstone bluffs on either side. But the key here, because of the word suf, is the red seaweed. The Hebrew does not mean reed in any way whatsoever. And the same Hebrew is in 1 Kings 9, verse 26. 1 Kings 9, verse 26, last thing. And this cannot be a 6-inch marshland. 1 Kings 9, verse 26. And Solomon made a navy of ships in Ezion-Geber, which is beside Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. Now, what did he do? Make little boats out of paper to float around in his bathtub? Took him down to a marshland, and he had all these nice little teeny wooden boats to float around in 6 inches of water. He had a navy. Solomon's navy was pretty large boats. He had them down at the Red Sea. He didn't build them and launch them in a little marshland. Somehow, the liberal just didn't carry this quite far enough to see where Solomon had built his boats and where he had set them sailing. And that 6 inches of water, then Solomon was quite a genius. Because I don't think there's anybody who's ever been able to build a navy and have it float in 6 inches of water. And this is not like Noah building an ark and then waiting for the water to rise. Solomon was not quite doing the same thing. Well, we'll talk about a few more things in this regard next time. Well, if it's corrected.
I know you didn't get it.
Well, it's in Exodus 14. It probably is chapters 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there. Okay?
Did you look in the box on the way in?
Yes, I picked it up. Thanks, Rick. What? Well, there are things that do happen like that. Sometimes, you know, we have a little breakdown in our system here.
I want to clear something up on the attendance book. It says I was absent with that, but I forgot to sign it as tardy.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you've been here then every time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks,
Bill. Sure.
Yeah. 705. If we miss next week, how do we take a check save on the tape library?
No, you just, well, you just...